Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Bill Lagner. He is principal and co-founder of Behring Asset Management. He and his managing partner, Kevin Duffy, manage the Behring Fund using an Austrian School of Economics lens in terms of identifying boom-bust cycles, value in the marketplace, bubbles, and distortions created by both fiscal and monetary authorities. The Behring Fund was one of the top macro funds during the last bubble implosion of 07-09, and Behring Asset Management created the Behring Credit Bubble Index, available on the net, which features the various enablers of the last bubble beginning in 2004-2005. Bill's a graduate of University of Florida. He began the investment industry in the late 1980s, initially as a stockbroker, and then moved to the buy side at Fidelity Investments. He left Fidelity in late 1998 to manage his own investments, and he's been featured in Barron's, Reuters, CFA Magazine, and Business Insider. Welcome, Bill.
Richard, thank you for having me.
Great. I thought we'd take a look at a number of slides that you've provided, which we will make available on our website, downloadable, and also within a write-up as well, a summary of our discussion. And so you provided a number of very interesting slides. If we can begin with the first one, which shows sort of the last several years from 2003 up till currently on housing debt, non-housing debt, and how that maps, in particular, the non-housing debt to what looks like three bubbles: student loan, auto loan, and credit cards. Do you want to give some insight on that?
Yeah. So I think just to kind of give a perspective on where we are, where we've come from. So Kevin and I started Behring back in 02, and after the technology bubble had burst, we actually got very bullish. There were a lot of companies we were buying for literally cash in the bank. I mean, you were getting the companies for free, mainly technology, because it pretty washed out. But when we saw the central banks essentially go to panic mode and lower interest rates and essentially segue from a tech bubble to a credit bubble, we chronicled the entire episode and we created the Behring Credit Bubble Index that you mentioned and profited from the unwind. And the first sign of the unwind, right, was the collateral. The underlying collateral, or this fall collateral, inflated collateral, started going the opposite way. The home builders broke in 05, and then several years later, the ancillary enablers went along with it. But, what's interesting about this chart is that the housing debt really hasn't been increased. It's increased a bit since the crisis. It mm-hmm. came down, and it's been slowly increasing. And you do have, there have been some figures released recently where people are starting to tap the home equity lines, but nothing leading up to the OC. But non-housing debt, which this on the right there is being driven, number one, by student debt and the auto loan, which I think you and I and most of your listeners would agree are kind of are part of these echo bubbles that have been created post 09. And the figures are alarming. And I think one thing I was going to mention to get from the outset here is that we know what some of the student loan industry is pretty much underwritten by the government and the large banks, but the taxpayer, unfortunately, and then the credit card, which you see there. But there's an auto loan bubble, which we're going to get into, and the figures, they range. I've seen figures as high as, $1.5 trillion. But I think something I want listeners to understand is a lot of this industry is not securitized, and so there's a chunk of the industry that's essentially private automobile loans, and they're actually bundled and sold amongst high net worth investors. Don't ask me the total. Anecdotally, I've been trying to splice together some of these figures. I can tell you with quite a bit of certainty it's a big number, and so the number is probably larger than what that graph reflects to the right.
And what would be the effect of some recent announcements by the government in terms of the student loan forgiveness?
Yeah, good question. So first of all, sadly, and this is very sad because, you know, going to school in the 80s, I actually had several jobs in college and graduated with money. And today these children are graduating. Well, they're not children, but young adults are graduating with quite a bit of debt, even if they do have some type of a relevant degree vis-a-vis the workforce, they're not finding employment, and so it's very difficult to service debt. And the government, just like they've done in the housing market, they've intervened and they've tried to recast the debt, alter the terms of the debt to try and extend, make the payments lower, right, and extend the terms, etc. And I think what's happened is we know that we've never really had a true recovery, and we've had asset bubbles, but the real economy, I think, is still struggling for a number of reasons, which we can get into. But what's happened is now there's been lobbying efforts in certain places where they want to forgive. They want to allow these people to essentially file bankruptcy. And of course, the taxpayer would eat that. It's just another example, I think, of, you know, the Austrians looking at, you know, this idea of monetary fiscal distortions, where the governments essentially subsidize credit. And when you subsidize credit, especially in the world we live in today, you end up getting a lot of these takers. They take the debt and they worry about repaying it later. So we'll see where the chips fall on this one, but the default rates, I mean, when Obama left office, I think they had one set of default figures. Then subsequent to his departure, another set were introduced, and the figures were significantly higher. What is the real default rate? What's the definition of a default? I think your listeners know the definition of a default. My guess is you've got more than half of the loans that are highly delinquent, over 60 days, or defaulted.
And how long could these bubbles go on for before there's some breakdown in terms of a potential for another financial crisis?
Yeah, that's the multi-trillion dollar question. I think if we knew that, we'd own a few islands. Let's look at bubbles, right? So Kevin, I didn't meet Kevin until 1994, but Kevin wrote a piece with the Wall Street Journal in the op-ed about, you know, everybody's worried about Japan taking over the world, how Japan was not going to take over the world for a number of reasons. But one was that their economy was a bubble and they had owned a lot of U.S. real estate, et cetera. And what was interesting about their bubble in real estate, specifically because real estate prices became wildly inflated, in fact, more so than some of the bubbles we witnessed during our own housing bubble and the most recent bubble in Canada in terms of prices to wages, they were issuing 100-year mortgages. And if the person borrowing money died, his wife would inherit the mortgage. And then when she died, the children would inherit the mortgage. So that's how you underwrite a bubble, right? You create these kind of lunatic fringe type policies, again, underwritten by policymakers. And look, we've already seen this kind of go on longer than what most people on your program would have thought, altering the mortgages, extending the terms. During the crisis or subsequent to the crisis, there were people not paying their mortgage for 2 or 3 years. The taxpayer was essentially subsidizing these programs where they would stay in their home. They'd recast the mortgage and lowered interest rates, and they're attempting to try and paper over this. But I think the real economy has been hollowed out. I think that is the main premise that the bears have is, look, by essentially destroying the foundation, a true, vibrant, dynamic economy that has, you know, very low regulation or no regulation, little or no taxes, and incentives for capital to be formed and reinvested, et cetera, and production, you know, you wouldn't see this. So I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that the economy is fragile. We're seeing sectors of the economy rolling over and asset prices following suit. but the broad market, which is still levitating, and it's a very small group of stocks, right? We know that the culprits, it's Amazon, it's Facebook, it's Tesla, it's a cast of the Apple and so on. It's these large companies, platform-like companies that have been levitating the market. And I think the central bank is raising interest rates, although I don't see them taking interest rates anywhere near the rate of the cost of living increases every year for that matter. So credit is starting to tighten in parts of the economy. So usually when you have credit tightening and there's bubbles that it's set upon, that's usually a recipe for disaster. But we don't know. I mean, let's play the movie out. I mean, we could see a scenario where the economy radically slows in the second half of the year, which is what Kevin and I see. It's just a kind of a continuation of this slow grinding. You know, the retail sector is basically going through an implosion. And the Fed could start cutting interest rates. And who's to say that the central banks collectively don't go to negative 100 basis points or 200 basis points to try and put some kind of a floor under housing, which is one of the biggest, you know, asset markets in the U.S. anyway. And then take mortgages from 30 years to 50 years. I mean, when you let your mind get creative in a fiat system, there's no limit to what they can do. Of course, it's a confidence game. And if more and more people start fleeing dollars or euros or pounds and buy gold or Bitcoin or a farm or what have you, then, you know, then you're getting more signs of confidence, and then you can end up having a major currency crisis in the developed world.
Yeah, and you've provided some additional charts. If we can delve deeper into the auto loan bubble, you've provided some charts on U.S. car loans, leasing car bubble. Can you speak to those charts?
Yeah. So again, let's run through kind of the rescue mission by the central planners. And that would be, you know, the Federal Reserve here, the Bank of England, the ECB. And let's face it, I mean, they've all kind of acted the same way. They've cut interest rates. The governments have come in and created various fiscal interventions to try and provide credit to different groups. And, you know, when governments or banks provide credit, people either take it or they don't. In this case, they took it again, especially in the West, here in the U.S. And we got to see car loans, which, you know, years ago you would have a car dealer underwrite the loan for 4 years. And then it went to five. And then over the last, during this cycle, this last 7 year cycle, you know, you're reading about 9 year car loans, and some of which were sold off right to Wall Street and securitized. Others were actually held by respective automobile dealers, et cetera. Or a secondary market was formed. And you would then ask yourself, well, gosh, what secondary market would even exist to buy 9 year car loans? Well, when you have a pool of savings, and in this country, there, even after the crisis, there was a pool of savings of several trillion dollars sitting in cash, money markets. After the first year, people probably don't do anything. After the second year, what's happening is the central banks have essentially pushed people into the deep end of the pool. And people start doing things with safe money that they would not typically do. Well, when enough people do it, and you've got a little bit of momentum from this massive, again, credit boom, this echo boom, if you will. Like I said, housing did not parts of the U.S., yes, housing's become inflated again, but nothing like the multiples we saw back in 07 and 08. So this whole boom in subprime and even non-subprime lending, part of it's been underwritten by historically safe money, which is really the sad characteristic here, because, you know, and if you had natural interest rates, and let's say the natural rate, we don't know what it's been because it's everything's run by the central bank, but let's say it was 3%. maybe a much, much smaller portion of that money, right, would find its way into the deep end of the pool. So they've underwritten this. There's a secondary market for some of this. You see some of the figures there. You can clearly see more cracks in the facade. But I think what I've been reading lately and talking to people that know the space, what's happening is someone will originate a loan that's non-securitized, and the default rates start going up. Let's say the secondary market starts repricing certain percentages of defaults at let's say 20% to par discount, and a secondary market exists, and some distressed buyer thinks he's going to buy it and maybe alter the terms and take on, again, a lot of risk. But if someone's defaulted once, there's a high probability in this business anyway of them defaulting again. So it's a bizarre world of, again, credit finding its way into a part of the market that would typically charge a very high rate of interest, and it wouldn't attract as much capital as it has. So again, another distortion from a central bank folly.
And I guess further to that, the sort of non-banking sector, the so-called shadow banking industry, you're hearing stories, anecdotal evidence, and just hearing about developments whereby there's a lot more going on than what meets the eye in terms of these official statistics from the charts that you display. For example, I think we were talking earlier about loans originating with regards to robo-advisors. Would you like to speak to that in terms of those stories?
Yeah, great question. Let me just touch on the lease bubble, because the lease bubble is, of course, correlated with the purchase bubble. The lease bubble is primarily underwritten by the automobile companies themselves, and the ability for these companies to, post-'09, go to the bond market. I think we've covered in some of the prior interviews the amount of corporate debt issuance, and of course the automobile lenders, automobile manufacturers, I should say, I'm sorry, became the credit providers of these quote-unquote leases. And the terms in the lease market became loose, right? When you're able to borrow money at Honda, for example, borrowing money at 3%, or Toyota, they become financial engineers. And so it flows through either on the purchase side and or the lease side. And you essentially get more of these cars leased. And if you look at that graph of off-lease vehicles coming in 17 and 18, I mean, you're talking about almost 4 million vehicles. And I think last year, what did we sell? 16.5 million vehicles. So that's a big number. And you're finally getting it now in terms of the secondary pricing market. So there's been enough leases coming off in 16 where prices have rolled over. And my guess is at the end of this year and the first half of next year, you'll get another pretty significant repricing on cars to the downside. And that is the equivalent of the home prices, right, rolling over back in 2006 and 5. And then it took a while, but then, of course, the mortgages that were part of those collateral pieces fell apart and the secondary market locked down. With regards to lending in the, people call it the shadow market or the non-securitized, non-banking market, there was an article in the last 6 weeks that came out where you've got various, these are either peer-to-peer lenders, and that's another bubble. I should have sent a chart to you on peer-to-peer lending. I can actually send it to you after we're done here. But basically, peer-to-peer lending has been massive the last 3 years. And then you have these kind of other, these wealth advisors, robo-advisors, where, like, I don't know the names of the companies off the top of my head, but there are several of them that offer credit lines against your stock and bond portfolio. Well, the robo-advisors plus kind of a series of these security lenders that are non-broker dealer, non-bank lenders have been lending money against securities. And I've read, it's very difficult to quantify this. Some of these people, experts, were saying, well, it's maybe 250 billion. But when you really think about, you look at the peer-to-peer lending world, and then you look at some of the anecdotal pieces on other again, non-bank, you know, non-securitization lenders against assets, securities, you could see a number close to $300 or $400 billion very easily, you know, just based upon all the new credit that's been created the last 5 years. So if you add that to the margin debt figures, well, now you're talking about margin debt approaching $1 trillion, right? Because that's technically liens on overvalued securities. So it's fascinating. And again, we've had this kind of levitating bubble now, and it's been going on for so long that the credit finds its way into other, again, the asset economy.
Now, to what extent could the Federal Reserve do a bailout or provide monetary policy to address the bursting of a non-banking bubble, if you will?
That's another very good question. Well, let's start with the banking side, right? So Banco Popular is on the verge of going defunct. And so there's rumors tonight in Spain of a bail-in. Stock's been kind of indicating that this was coming. And Italy had a couple of bail-ins last year. So on the banking side, I think it's pretty certain that the bail-in model is probably going to be implemented, you know, through the developed world. In terms of the Federal Reserve Bank bailing out non-bank lenders, I don't see it happening. I could be dead wrong. I just don't see. I think what's going to happen is they're going to allow more failures this go around. I think they've kind of warned a number of these lenders. There's been several stress tests, even though those were kind of comical, but I don't see where they step into a non-bank lender. Again, I could be wrong. I just think they're going to have to let certain things fail. But look, maybe what they do is they decide to let several go, and it creates another, you know, domino effect. And they like they did last time, right? They stuck their hand in, stopped the dominoes from falling, and created all these new government subsidized credit facilities.
Yeah, and also maybe lower interest rates on the low end of the yield curve.
Yeah. Look, housing, I think what's interesting is, look, let's be very confident of one thing. The government here, in my opinion, will do everything imaginable to try and prop up housing. That's not going to stop it from going down. Housing prices are going to go down. But I think they will come up with all types of creative ways to keep people in their homes. Some things that you and I have probably never even contemplated. They're going to do something like that. They're not going to sit idle and watch housing go down, you know, 60-70%. So I think housing is something they'll continue to tamper with. Car loans and student loans, credit cards, those are, you know, I mean, they're big numbers in total, the three, but I don't think the federal government or the Federal Reserve is going to get anywhere near that, actually.
Yeah, I think the same approach in Canada up here, where it's the government is not likely to let the Canadian housing prices go down much as well. The same idea because of there's a CMHC type of financing similar to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and that would basically force the federal government to get in and pay out on insurance policies if the price goes lower and people start walking.
So let's talk about Canada, because I have a great story to share with your listeners. I was in New York a few weeks ago for a conference, for a fintech conference.
Yeah.
Macro speakers there, fintech, and I got an Uber from LaGuardia, and I ended up getting an Uber share. I didn't select a share. So yeah. I had a woman get in the car, and she was basically in town on business, but she was bragging to me about flipping condos in Toronto.
Oh my, okay.
And it was the same, Richard, it was the same thing that I witnessed in 2006 in San Diego. And she was probably in her late 20s. And I thought she owned like one or two condos. Well, between her and her brother, they had a dozen, and probably one of the nicest towers in Toronto. So I do know enough about Canada, and full disclosure, we're short some of the enablers in the Canadian housing bubble. But I think housing prices in Canada will go down a lot. I do think that the governments, again, will lower rates and figure out ways to provide credit to people and maybe extend, maybe come up with 50-year mortgages. But again, that's not going to stop, you know, housing prices to getting back to something closer to, you know, the norm in terms of wages, right, in Toronto and Calgary, where these bubbles have been in the past.
Yeah, and off another story here, there was 79 units, townhouses that went up in the market a couple of months ago, and they were basically in the 1.2 to 1.5 million range. They all went in one day, mostly to overseas investors like from China, Shanghai, and it's basically a model of putting up a very small amount with the promise or obligation to come up with something like $100,000 over the next 6 months or so. So you have, you know, you have that amount of time to flip or, you know, sell it at that time in some way to not have to pay the $100,000. In other words, so but yeah, all 79 went up in one day.
Wow.
Here.
Yeah. Yeah, we've created, I mean, what's amazing about this conversation is we've, over the last 6-7 years, we've essentially underwritten a casino-like economy. And, yeah, that doesn't end well, obviously. And it's amazing how many people are in the casino, right, gambling. It's true, especially after what we went through in the U.S. back in 2009.
Exactly. Maybe we could talk about the fintech revolution as a positive note to end the discussion, but just your thoughts on fintech, where it is, where it's potentially going, blockchain technologies, cryptocurrencies, where is it all heading?
Yeah, look, I think it's one of the most fascinating things that we've seen in the last 25 years. I mean, the internet was fascinating starting in the mid 90s and the whole technology revolution and the benefits it's provided humanity. When you look at there's a lot of this cryptocurrency that's being created and initial coin offerings, etc., that are I would just raise an eyebrow. I'd be very suspect of a lot of it, but there's also some of it that is real. I think, you know, people look at Bitcoin, they say, well, is it a bubble? Is it currency? And I think the fascinating part about Bitcoin is, of course, it was the first to market, but it's basically it's a borderless way of transacting value through the rail system known as the public blockchain. There's so many blocks in it now. It's a little slow. I mean, you're a technology expert, so I'd actually defer to you on how to remedy the blockchain speed, but what's happening is you've got really, really smart entrepreneurs that are throwing a lot of resource into creating. What they're doing is just using technology and decentralization to create alternative ways of holding and sending value. And when you say, okay, that's interesting, but what does that really mean? Well, it's an industry that's run by centralized parties, banks, and they take somewhere between, you know, call it $3 to $4 trillion a year out of the global economy through foreign exchange fees, credit card fees, bounce check fees, ATM fees. I go on down the line. And so by creating these alternative forms of exchanging value that are decentralized and that are actually innovative and creative, you create an ecosystem where more people are exchanging products and services, and they're doing it without traditional friction points from all these authorities. And so you have the dollar and the euro and the pound, which are these fiat currencies, and people are losing confidence in them because they've been printing so much of them and keeping interest rates below the rate of inflation. And so you have a parallel ecosystem, right, that's operating. People say, well, it's the underground economy or it's the dark economy. Look, it's part of this whole fabric of economic action, and watching it compete with a fiat system that's flawed and centralized, to me, it's one of the most fascinating things that we're going to see. I think you will see bubbles eventually emerge from, we may be in the early stages of some of these alternative currencies becoming bubbles. But look, I mean, isn't the real bubble the money bubble, since they've created so much fiat money since the debacle in 09? I mean, isn't that really the bubble?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I say watch it. It's very volatile. It's not for the faint at heart, but I think there are very interesting entrepreneurs, credible entrepreneurs, throwing a lot of human and financial capital at it. I'm simply amazed when I meet some of these people, and what they're really doing at the end of the day, Richard, is you've got a lot of people creating solutions to a system that's very broken. So that's actually very positive, and it's something we should actually be welcoming.
And what does that present to investors in terms of asset categories, asset classes for being able to participate in this revolution?
Yeah, so look, buying my first Bitcoin years ago at a coffee shop was an interesting experience.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. You know, that was the early days. But now there's different exchanges that you could buy, you know, several of these more developed cryptocurrencies. There is a whole platform of smart contracts built around Ethereum, which is another cryptocurrency. They've all run up a lot. I'm not telling your viewers to go buy them. I think they're very volatile, and you know, we're in the first inning. This is a 9-inning game. But what's happening with smart contracts, what's happening the peer-to-peer value exchange, it's interesting. A lot of these companies are still private. I don't really know of any public companies that have there's a company in Russia that's toying with the idea of accepting Bitcoin and making Bitcoin available to buy and sell, and I guess they're plugged into exchanges, so there's digital exchanges being formed. I would say you're probably a year or two away from these companies going public. And you know, you could go to some of these places like CoinDesk.com and others and read about the world of cryptography. I think there's a lot that needs to get sorted out. You're a tech expert in terms of security, the blockchain, scalability issues, and then trying to take something that's very technical and very complex, and then you have to filter it all the way down to something that's convenient and user-friendly for people. But people are moving to these platforms, and the regulators are lightly regulating them. And so my guess is, like the internet, the regulators are probably going to be relatively hands off, and you'll see evolution happen.
And do you see this as evolving also into the government sector, like governments getting into cryptocurrencies based on their government fiat currency?
Yeah, great question. So they're already, I mean, India's developing what they call the India stack. And I guess in India, there's a high level of identity fraud and so on. And the governments have been spending inordinate amounts of money trying to ferret out that fraud, et cetera. So they're creating this India stack, which is basically a whole digital universe, from your identification to getting your healthcare. Of course, it's not a true competitive healthcare market there, and then banking, and so they're trying to move towards a full stack of digital. They call it digital inclusion. It's actually puts a chill up my spine when I hear digital inclusion.
Okay.
But so maybe the government's looking at it as a way, right, to try and lower their friction points, but then the free market guy like you and I would say, well, why is the government even in these businesses? But yeah, they may create a digital dollar. They may do away with checks and so on. But I think, again, the takeaway from all this is you now have true, Hayek is alive and well, right? So true competition to fiat currency is happening, and watching it unfold, it's fascinating.
It is. That's a great insight, Phil, as always. Just wondering, how could our listeners learn more about your work?
So Kevin and I, we have a blog, bearingasset.com/blog. And then you can, then from the blog, you can go to our website, which is bearingasset.com, and learn more about what we do. We manage a couple of private funds, and we're also on Twitter. And so you can find us as well on Twitter.
Great. Thank you very much for being on the program show, Bill.
Thank you, Richard, for having me, and look forward to our discussions in the future.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.